On Radio 4 Longwave and Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by John Forrest. Now here on Radio 4 FM, our new book of the week, Comandante, Rory Carroll's biography of Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president who died earlier this month. During his 14 years in office, Chavez was idolized by many, especially the Venezuelan poor, and vilified by others, including the Bush administration. A self-defined socialist, he nevertheless remained hard to categorize. His impromptu speeches and songs became a trademark. For 6 years during Chavez's mercurial rule, the author, Rory Carroll, was The Guardian's Latin American correspondent operating out of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. The reader is Jack Claff.
It was approaching midnight when the Venezuelan Air Force plane climbed over Havana and wheeled south, skimming over a moonlit Caribbean bound for Caracas. Gabriel Garcia Marquez sat with a pen and notebook next to Hugo Chavez. Both men had been guests of Fidel Castro. Cuba's old fox had taken a close interest in the Venezuelan, and now it was the turn of the Nobel laureate. It was January 1999, and Chavez was returning to his homeland to be sworn in as president. He had won an election a few weeks earlier and was set at 44 to become the republic's youngest leader. A Colombian magazine had commissioned Garcia Marquez to write a profile. Before finding fame as a novelist, Gabo, as friends called him, had been a newspaper reporter and still had a newsman's instinct to interview and probe. Chavez had yet to take office, and already his rise seemed extraordinary. Venezuela had once been considered South America's most successful and therefore boring country, a realm of oil wealth and beauty queens that sat out the region's dictatorships and revolutions in a haze of petrodollar complacency and bloodless elections. That changed one explosive night in February 1992, when an unknown lieutenant colonel named Hugo Chavez attempted a coup and sent tanks and soldiers to assault the presidential palace, Miraflores. The coup failed and Chavez went to jail, but 6 years later he stormed back as an election candidate, swept aside rivals, and here he was, president-to-be, flying beneath the stars to an unwritten fate. Garcia Marquez had special reason to accept this assignment. In novels such as The Autumn of the Patriarch and The General in His Labyrinth, he had explored the psychologies of Caribbean leaders. Many dictators had thrived on these humid coasts over two centuries and woven themselves into the culture as mythic personages. The master of magical realism studied and did not necessarily condemn them. Having just won a clean landslide election, Chavez was no dictator, but came with a whiff of cordite. Supporters called him Comandante. Garcia Marquez's pen skimmed across the notepad as his interviewee related his childhood and political rise. The article observed, "The February coup seems to be the only thing that did not turn out well for Hugo Chavez Frias. He views it positively, however, as a providential reverse. It is his way of understanding good luck, or intelligence, or intuition, or astuteness, or whatever one can call the magic touch that has favoured him since he entered the world in Sabaneta in the state of Barinas on July the 28th, 1954. The son of poor primary school teachers, as a boy he excelled at painting, singing, and baseball. His dream was to pitch in the major leagues, and for that the best route was the military academy. The cadet gradually abandoned his fantasy of a roaring stadium because in the academy he fell in love with military theory, political science, and the history of Simón Bolívar, the liberator who expelled the Spanish from much of the continent in the 19th century." The profile continued recounting Chavez's narrative, his fascination with family history, his indignation at Venezuela's social inequalities, his gathering of fellow officers into a conspiracy in the 1980s to overthrow a corrupt state and usher in a real democracy to make Simón Bolívar proud. Chavez also gave Garcia Marquez a small scoop, revealing a previously unknown co-conspirator in the failed coup, a fourth man who happened to be on the plane. He pointed a finger at a man in a seat by himself and said, "Colonel Badwell." All this the article related in an affectionate tone that was not surprising. The famous chronicler shared Chavez's leftward political tilt and anger at Latin America's extreme wealth inequalities. When the plane landed, it was 3 a.m. and Caracas glowed in the distance, a swamp of lights. Chavez embraced Garcia Marquez farewell and invited him to attend his inauguration. The old man stood on the asphalt and watched his subject disappear into the night. We do not need to wonder what thought went through Garcia Marquez's mind. At the end of his article, a few short lines shook loose from everything that preceded them. "While he sauntered off with the bodyguards," wrote Marquez, "I was overwhelmed by the feeling that I had just been travelling and chatting pleasantly with two opposing men, one to whom the caprices of fate had given an opportunity to save his country, the other an illusionist who could pass into the history books as just another despot." Soon after the February 1999 inauguration, the Comandante acquired the habit of spending nights in Miraflores Palace rather than cross the city to La Casona, the presidential residence, where his wife, Maria Isabel, and children lived behind high white walls. He had spent most of his adult life in barracks and liked the order of having work and private life in the same place. And of course the palace, the same palace his soldiers had stormed during the coup attempt 7 years earlier, symbolized the power he had so long strived for. His quarters were austere, with a small, well-ordered bookcase with tracts on history, politics, philosophy, and literature. Upon Chavez's emerging, a waiter in a white jacket immediately served sweet black coffee in a small porcelain cup. The Comandante would carry this down to the Sala Situacional, the Situation Room, the nerve centre of the palace. The first briefing began with a media digest, including the regional papers outside Caracas and who said what on the early morning talk shows. Then a sketch of international events and the day's agenda of government and party business. If there were no emergencies, he took breakfast on a terrace. While eating, he would review letters thrust into his hand by supplicants during public events the day before, some just a few lines, others stretching over pages, all requesting something: a hip replacement, money to start a business, Christmas gifts for children, a car, a tractor. When he plunged into crowds, the president was mobbed by so many petitions an official wish-taker accompanied him. "The palace gave me a waistcoat and backpack, and I would follow the president through the crowds, taking all the letters people thrust at him," said a retired wish-taker. "My God, the whole city would turn up. Everybody wanted to embrace him and ask him something." The letters became so numerous, the palace created a special department of clerks to summarize them overnight in typed digests. This was what the president read over breakfast. When he put down his fork to circle a petition with a pen, it would receive attention from the special department, which archived every letter. It was called the Sala de la Esperanza, the Office of Hope. Upon taking office, the Comandante had inherited 21 ministries, and in the name of efficiency and lean government, reduced that to 14 and said the target was 9. This hacking did not last long. His impatience to change and create things nurtured bureaucratic abundance. Ministries sprouted new branches and new departments that divided, subdivided, fused, split. The cabinet reproduced and multiplied to 15, 20, 25, 30 ministries until even the Comandante lost count. Ministers rose and fell even faster than ministries. The Comandante went through more than 180 ministers in over a decade. Some lasted just a few weeks, snapped twigs, quickly forgotten. But the nimblest and most versatile survived year after year. With faces turned permanently towards the palace, they sank roots and colonized El Silencio, the government district. The oil boom that gushed ever-increasing torrents of petrodollars from 2004 gave a giddy air to ministers and courtiers at the palace. It inflamed ambition and insecurity. It dangled the promise of influence, status, and wealth with the dread of banishment. Attract the president's eye and elevation would be swift. Yesterday a nobody, today you beheld a fiefdom of influence and patronage. But the air was thin, the ledge slippery. When the Comandante started skipping cabinet meetings in 2004, jostling for the ear intensified. Ministers could spend weeks or months vainly seeking an audience. Desperate to know what the Comandante was thinking, ministers strained to pick up gossip, glean rumour, catch fragments. Chavez's gaze seemed to follow ministers every waking minute. From their mantelpieces and living room walls, it was wise to have portraits at home. From murals and billboards on their way to work. From their offices, from their desks, from the t-shirts of waiters who brought coffee. Viva Chavez! From the covers of newspapers, magazines, and government reports. A minister needed to master the balance between stillness and motion. Most of the time, a minister was stone. But upon command, the stone would transform into a whirling dervish. The Comandante's impulsiveness demanded instant, urgent responses. He would become consumed by a theme. Increase rice production. The order would ricochet through El Silencio. The agriculture, planning, transport, commerce, finance, and infrastructure ministers would work around the clock to have it ready, at least on paper, for the Comandante to unveil on his Sunday show. Then the next week, cheaper chicken. The same ministers would forget about rice while they rushed to squeeze farmers, truckers, and supermarkets so the Comandante could say on his next show, the chicken was cheaper. Clothing was another medium to express obedience. The Comandante liked red, so ministers wore red baseball caps, red t-shirts, red guayabaras, red skirts. State garment factories produced mountains of the stuff. Then, one day, the Comandante appeared on the palace balcony sporting a yellow shirt and said, without elaboration, there was too much red. Consternation around the palace. What to do? Some ministers hesitantly abandoned the colour, worrying it was a trick. Others flashed just a bit of red, trying to gauge the correct level. When, a few weeks later, the Comandante resumed wearing red, again, without elaboration, the crisis passed and ministers reverted to red. The principal source of paranoia was fear over what you said yourself. That somewhere, at some time, to someone, you would say something you should not. Home phones, office phones, and above all, mobile phones were assumed to be tapped. It was the reason high-ranking officials treated their phones as radioactive. When things got to be too much, some courtiers sought counsel from a small, wiry fortune-teller known as Rey David. His full name was David Gonçalves, and he had learned his trade, he said, from a Portuguese gypsy. Many Venezuelans are superstitious and blend Catholicism with a semi-clandestine jumble of astrology, mysticism, and santeria, a type of voodoo imported by slaves from Western Africa. Rich and poor alike believe it. So many anxious officials unloaded their troubles onto Rey David that he acquired inside knowledge of El Silencio's power struggles to the point he really could, in some ways, predict the future.
Comandante by Rory Carroll was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Jack Claff. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Comandante continues tomorrow with the story of the most turbulent years of Chavez's rule, 2002, when power was briefly snatched from his grasp. Later this morning, Jonathan Jenkins reports on the people who believe that the dead can speak to us through our radios thanks to electronic voice projection. Are there really ghosts in the machines? Find out in Out of the Ordinary at 11 o'clock. Before that, Jane Garvey asks if we're making too much of the makeover. And journalist Emma Brooks reveals her mother's secret past and why she inherited her gun. That's all in Woman's Hour. That's coming up after the news.
Returning to BBC Radio 4.
Hello, I'm Steve Punt and welcome to The Third Degree, a students versus lecturers quiz show.
Recorded on location at a different university each week.
It's tougher than University Challenge, not least because unlike them, we make the two teams actually sit on top of each other, for real.
Designed to tax the highest IQs.
Just one side squared.
This is what math sounds like when it's happening right in front of you, being performed by three non-mathematicians.
The Third Degree returns to BBC Radio 4 this afternoon at 3.